So I'm going to give a slightly less colorful talk than Laura gave, in fact dry according to Dan's standards, on EHT correlation, which is all the fun that happens behind the scenes at Bonn and Haystack once the palettes of modules show up. We've been doing this for a number of years. These are the same correlators that have been correlating the EHT for several years now. The only thing that's really going to change in the next years is that the number of palettes of data is going to increase substantially. So I should start with a great number of acknowledgments. I actually couldn't get all the names on there, but we are using the DiffX software correlator at this point. And so thanks go first to Adam Deller and Walter Briskin and the DiffX developer community who've built this thing pretty much on the side of their day jobs. Thanks to the to Roger Capallo, Mike Titus, and the rest of the Haystack correlation post-processing team with whom I've spent a lot of time working. And of course, across the APP collaborators, specifically Walter Olive and Helga Rothman and Nicolette Pradel for some of the information that I'll be sharing with you. Once again, this is a collaborative effort. Very little of it is mine, actually. So an overview of the talk, I'll briefly touch on what the EHT is going to need in the way of correlation. I'll tell you where we stand with the two correlators. And then I'll go into a laundry list of technical issues, which are all in the solved, but we have some interesting challenges ahead. And then a few final words on logistics. So the requirements, as I mentioned, we're using the DiffX software correlator. With many tears shed, the Haystack hardware correlator was finally dismantled. Bonn had given up on theirs several years earlier when it failed. We need to expand to something like 8 stations over the next 5-year period. 8 is just a rough number. It could be 7, it could be 10. That's not a big driver. Bandwidth is a big one. Up to date, we've been doing at most 8 gigabits per second in our recordings. That's the 2 512 megahertz bands in dual polarization. The target for March is 16 gigabit per second recording, so that's a 2 gigahertz band dual pole with some number of stations. And the eventual target is full bandwidth compatibility with ALMA, or if REMO has his way, twice that. And again, something like eight stations. Some of the requirement is a bit nebulous in that once you've purchased the computer equipment, the thing sits there and grinds, and so the nebulous piece is, well, how quickly do you need to have an answer? And that ranges from, oh, by tomorrow to, well, a few weeks would be okay. So that's where it gets to be a gray area, and it basically comes down to what you can afford. For some of the estimates that we came up with for a timely processing of the data, subject to all these nebulous constraints, was something like 400 processing cores in the sense that DiffX uses them. So here's a pretty picture of the current Bonn VLBI correlator. I can't say I've ever seen a machine with such nicely organized cables. I'm glad Alan showed his Apex cabling scheme to prove that it's not a German trade. That, of course, is current, and they're throwing it all away because they have the society has approved their proposal for a new cluster. So they're going to boost up to something like 1,400 cores with better than 40 gigabit InfiniBand switch fabric, something like 6 Mark VI recorders. And the crude estimate is that that'll be about 5 times faster than the current cluster, which, when it's not doing EHT work, is in full use for geodetic and general supercomputer work. Their procurement for installation is going to start early next year. And their major uncertainty is basically with what the Mark VI is going to do for them, because that's completely new to them. And presumably over the few months following the arrival of the spring data, we'll all have a very good idea how to operate these things. Here's a couple photos of the Haystack correlator. As I mentioned, on the right-hand, let's see, your right-hand side is the what used to be the rack of hardware for the Haystack correlator. The blue racks are all that are left of the Haystack correlator, which is to say the Mark V units, which are currently used for geodetic work, but are at this point completely irrelevant for the EHT, although they've done their fair share of service. At the two ends, at the far end is the software correlator itself with a rack of nodes. And on the front end of that is a newly installed rack of Mark VIs, which is the first installment on the full complement of Mark VIs that will support the playback. So we too have an upgrade planned. The immediate programmatic one is to support the APP commissioning activities, which conveniently line up with the March 2015 campaign. So we have a chance to support what we need for the March campaign, test stuff that is required for ALMA. And based on what we learned through that experience, we're in a good position to make targeted purchases for the following years to build up to what the full EHT requirement is. And for some reason, the final point there is that when we get to 64 gigabits per second, the data all comes in separate bands, and they are completely unrelated to each other. So we do have the luxury of making subsequent passes through the data. So in some sense, we don't need four times as much processing if we're willing to wait four times as long. So let's see, technical issues. The first one that in some random order is the question of Mark VI playback. The data comes into the Mark VIs on two dual-ported NIC cards, of which only one is used for the 16 gigabits per second. Turns out the cards are actually capable of pumping out 20 gigabits per second. So if you, I'll show you a plot that we did from some disk testing of Dan's disks. I beat on them pretty hard before they were thrown in the shipping containers, or casually tossed in the shipping containers, to make sure that they actually could stand up to what he's going to need from them. Having a disk fail in the South Pole would be horrible. The horizontal axis here is file count, where I just basically brutally wrote 10 gigabyte files going across. Did that a bunch of times. The red is the write rate, which is what's important for VLBI recording. And the bottom line there is actually just above the bare minimum of what the disks have to do in order to keep up with 16 gigabit per second recording. The stripy pattern is kind of interesting. That's some kind of MRI diagnostic of the heads moving around on the disk platters. The green is the playback story. And playback is always faster because you don't have to check what you've written. So I sort of drew a casual green bar through there at the read speed, sort of an eyeball mean. And that actually suggests that we ought to be able to play back much faster than we are recording and comparable to the dual-ported NIC speed. So that, I think, is a piece of good news. Going back, the Mark VIs record in this so-called scatter-gather mode where the data is scattered to the separate disks in a way that if there's disk failures, recovery from that is much easier. As opposed to a standard RAID situation where if disks fail, rebuilding RAIDs is definitely not fun and you have to know what you're doing. And we decided not to acquire that expertise. For playback, it turns out that you can build a so-called Fuse file system in user space Linux application, which basically hides all of that from you so that to the user, and in particular to DIFX, each scan appears as a single file. At the moment, we have a working prototype that basically performs the essential functions. And there's a number of minor cleanup issues that are planned between now and spring. I did use it extensively in the last month when I was down at ALMA. We have currently four recorders installed at ALMA, which is actually a pretty nice little computing cluster. And that capability was used extensively to do DIFX correlations. It all worked pretty flawlessly. Let's see, the second technical issue here. This is a bit of a nuisance. One of our problems with all of our software, from DIFX through the analysis software, is it was all written in an earlier framework with different ways of doing things. Our data is coming to DIFX as multiple data streams, basically an X polarization, a Y polarization in different bands. And the construction of the organization of experiments is specified in the VEX file, and the way DIFX was written essentially said, you're doing single pole, one band, right? So the notion of multiple data streams per antenna is somewhat foreign. There's a very easy lie to the system that you can do, which is to say, I happen to have several antennas that are co-located with each other, and diffx happily correlates it, and cleaning up the damage later is not too hard, but it's sort of inconvenient, and that's one of the things that needs to be fixed for efficient correlator operations. A minor detail is that the 16 gigabit recording goes onto four separate modules. We've arranged things so that the polarizations winds up in pairs. So it's going to be important logistically to keep those pairs together, or you basically lose half of the data from each pole, or you know, there are various ways to screw that up. And there's a bunch of other nits that we should be fixing. As I mentioned, VEX has been at release 1.5 for, I don't know, several decades. And VEX 2.0 has been announced, which actually contains the language for expressing the sort of thing that we're doing. So the good news is that there's a roadmap for how to take all of our software there over the next few years. The bad news is none of that's been done yet, but that gives us something to do for the next few years. For those of you not familiar with DiffX, this is just a little cartoon, which it's kind of hard to pick one to show it, but the top, you see here the data on the disk, and from the DiffX perspective, it essentially assigns one processing core within the Mark VI to handle all the reading and unpacking of the data. So however many antennas and data streams, you have a core scattered across the Mark VIs that do that. And then that data is time sliced and passed, all the data from some time range is passed to some processing core within your cluster to do the rather boring but and exceedingly repetitive cross-multiply and accumulate. And the answers go out to the FX manager, which is one distinguished node that collects this rather feeble trickle of real data, which then goes out to the file system for further analysis. Another technical issue is polarization. As has been mentioned before, ALMA doesn't like circular quarter wave plates installed on all of their 66 antennas. So we've opted to just lie to DiffX. It doesn't actually care that it's working with left, right, X, Y, H, V, or whatever you choose to call it. Correlation is correlation. And so we've opted to lie to DiffX. We'll pass the data through and then clean up the damage at the back end, which is really just a bunch of bureaucracy and some trivial matrix multiplications. Yvonne Martí-Vidal is going to be talking about that next, and he'll go into far more detail, so I'm not going to say any more. Except that we need to be careful to take calibration data so that he can do a good job. This is perhaps the most daunting technical issue we have ahead of us. Nomenclature is nomenclature. Channels, FFTs, DFTs, zoom band resampling. It's all coming from the fact that we're working with a heterogeneous array of telescopes where each observatory was built for some reason other than ours. We're bolting some kind of VLBI back end and trying to make sense of all this stuff. The FFT comes in because that was the first and most efficient Fourier transforming algorithm, and our whole world has been built on that. But the algorithm folks went off and figured out, actually not too much later, that you could actually work with non-powers of two and not do a terrible job at things. So that capability was incorporated and is in DiffX and has been there for a while. And when we proposed the ALMA phasing project, we plan to make heavy use of this, where essentially you can do FFTs on traditional stations, DFTs on the ALMA station, which has this magic power of five thrown in, and then use this special purpose mode called zoom band, which lets you identify subbands or channels out of whole cloth. And pull out what you need. In our planning for that, we had some vision of how the world would work someday. As you may have gleaned from some of these talks, our plans are not exactly where we are today. Historically, the R1 DBE has 15 usable 32 megahertz channels. ALMA has 32 62.5 megahertz channels, so that's where the sampling rate issue comes in. The sampling in that channel is 125 mega samples per second, as opposed to, say, 128 mega samples per second if you had 64 megahertz channels, which we thought we might have, but we aren't quite there yet. Instead, we've got 1.2 gigahertz channel. So that actually, at the moment, is a nice feature because we just pull the data we need out of that larger channel. We don't have to worry about lining up channels. In the future, as Laura indicated, there are many more possibilities for what might be done with the R2 DBE. I think it's fair to say we're going to get through March and learn a lot and make plans for the future as to what's optimal in the scientific sense once we get through that experience. The DBBC3 is coming online, and that has even more flexible capabilities, which can make things some things easier, perhaps. So that's, let's see, where am I? So as I indicated, for the ALMA project, we knew we had to deal with this. So the Asia A group has been hard at work coming up with software to automate some of the drudgery of getting the channels to line up. And that capability is now within DiffX, thanks to Nicolas and his team. And these are some cartoons of how, if you had 64 contiguous 64 megahertz channels, how you might tune the ALMA 62.5 megahertz channels to get them to line up, so you can try to correlate this one with this and this with this. And there's a little bit of bandwidth that you have to leave on the floor just because the sample rates are different, and there's no way around that. There are a number of different possibilities. This is a case where you actually want to target, say, what Karma has, where you have 32 megahertz channels. And again, the goal was to work this out automatically, because it is fairly straightforward, but it's kind of tedious if you have to do this for petabytes of data. To test all this, they built a simulator, which I won't go into it in detail, but it was basically designed to test these new capabilities of DiffX in the absence of data. But basically, there's some setup stuff where you design your simulated experiment. You run this program that substitutes for going to mountaintops and taking data when it's very cold and there's no air to breathe. And then at that point, you have data that you can then pass to DiffX and correlate just as if nothing else had happened. And they've done that. And here's an example here of a simulated observation of, oh, I don't know which source that is, 0750558. And it has a beautiful fringe and all the rest of that stuff. So it's all working. Just to give you a sample of how flexible and challenging this system is, this is a correlation that I did a number of times at ALMA, where we were actually using ALMA's traditional tuning mode for its tunable filter banks. And basically, the astronomers want to see a 2 gigahertz band, and they don't care about 62.5 megahertz channels. They want 0 to 2 gigahertz, although actually it turns out to be 1.85 megahertz. Excuse me. Because what they do is they jam these channels together in a way where each tunable filter bank channel actually overlaps the previous one. So one of the challenges with doing the zoom banding thing is you now actually, for some regions, have a choice of data. You could pull it from the obvious channel, or you could pull it from this channel where the signal's dying away. So if you want to actually get a correlation, you have to be very careful to set up your zoom bands so that you don't step in there. And then so that's the first constraint on the placement of the channel. Spacing of the frequency sampling is another one where you have to get the numerics right so you can satisfy the alignment of everything and ultimately get to something which Forfeit is happy with, because Forfeit, which is our principal analysis tool here, hasn't ever heard of DFTs or anything other than FFTs, so it wants to see a nice channel with a power of 2 number of spectral points. So anyway, it's a bit of a pain to set up, but once you've set it up, you turn the crank on gigabytes, terabytes of data, and you get fringes such as this, where I performed a little experiment with one antenna at ALMA pointed at 1924292, passed exactly that same signal through 2 of ALMA's correlation quadrants, and you get essentially perfect correlation. It's sort of a zero baseline test, but it shows that you can go through all these motions. So as I mentioned, ALMA has these wonderfully flexible tuning bands which line up with the channels that are recorded sent to the recorder. That's the good news. The bad news is that not only do they have this power factor of 5 thrown into their frequency, but then they turned around and did it only in powers of 2, so that the alignment of the filter banks has to come out at 30 kilohertz channel placements, which throws yet another monkey wrench into that. Now, there is a technology that's in DiffX called LO offsetting, which basically does a fringe rotation to shift the channel over. That was part of what the AJ group was testing. That's all been worked out, and it got its first trial by fire in the South Pole Telescope testing Laura mentioned, because one of the features with an asterisk, which is to say bug, of the block down converter is that it does a very nice job of giving you a stable frequency LO, but it has its own mind about what frequency it's actually going to give you in terms of slightly different than what you asked for. For the experiment, we were aware of that, and we tried to tune it up to exactly what we wanted, but it had a mind of its own, and it actually shifted frequencies on us for reasons that probably have to do with a reset. So in the end, we actually wound up processing the experiment using this LO offset technique. And as Laura showed you, we got a perfectly fine fringe. So this is sort of a grab bag of things that we know we need to do in the next few years to get to more efficient operations. The eNoise simulator is capable, but we need to be able to simulate faster so that we can test more of this stuff before we have real data. I suspect once we have real data, we may stop simulating, but we're not there yet. One of the tools in the DiffX correlation chain is the so-called DiffX to Mark IV, which takes what DiffX produces and produces the lie that says, oh, by the way, this was correlated on the Mark IV correlator, so that the subsequent analysis chain can work with that. As I said, it doesn't know anything about powers of non-powers of two FFTs, so there's some adjustments to that tool, which if we were to basically pad the channels, we could then carry on as if nothing had happened. That's one possible augmentation. Our workhorse of forfeit, which does the fringe fitting, as I said, is wedded to powers of two. Going through that systematically and depower of twoing it is a fairly straightforward but tedious task, as there's a lot of heritage in there that has to be understood and re-engineered to accommodate non-FFTs. It's all doable, and it's stuff that we'll do, with time. The final slide I have here is on logistics. We have two correlators. It would be a good plan to figure out how to manage the load. There are a number of different options for that. You can take your modules, and you can we've had reasonable results with taking different sessions or different parts of observing nights and sending the modules to different places. That works if you plan ahead at the sites with what you record there. When we get to 64 gigabits per second, we'll have different frequency bands, so we could send every other band to the two correlators or something. The only caveat is that you have to be careful to keep your polarizations together, otherwise you can't correlate what you get. And there are some other options in the future depending on what happens with the digital backends. Historically, there hasn't been the manpower or the time or the resources to correlate everything in both places at the same time, so that's probably not what we want to be doing. On the other hand, we're all using the same software. We can all agree on exactly how we're correlating, and at the end of the day, the bits are the bits. So sharing the correlation products is probably the same thing to be doing. And of course, we have two correlators and two teams, so we get a lot of cross-checking between what each produces, so we can do a lot of quality control on the results. And I think that was all I had. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. A question?
So one of the very early requirements that you listed was essentially cadence, was how can you keep up with the observations? And so I just wanted to ask, when we're talking about 1 week of real observations a year, so that's seven nights, maybe you do that twice a year, it sounds like you've already factored that in. But if this were to move to a monitoring experiment and there was going to be 30 nights a year or 60 nights a year, is it? First, could you already handle that? And second, is it scalable at the level that it really is just double the size of the hardware?
I think the major, honestly, the critical link in this isn't the machines. It's the people who have to figure out what to do. And I think one of the biggest things that makes it time intensive is doing something different every year. Every year we've done this, we've done essentially something different. except for the years where we actually didn't have a campaign because it was going to be the same old stuff and nothing new. So I think in the longer term, to be able to do monitoring or quick turnaround, and especially of turnkey operations at the sites, it's really not hard to do some quick correlation, to set up correlations that's just like what you did 3 months ago. You change the times, you change the observing schedule, and you've got the machinery to just crank it out. So I don't think that's really a problem.
So it's nearly real-time correlation then?
Well, you know, the bar to real-time correlation, of course, is the bandwidth of the telescopes.
Certainly. But night on the telescope, a month later, turns into one night on the correlator. Once you've got the...
You can do a lot in a night. It's the night on the correlator, but if it's preceded by a week of figuring out how to set it up, that's where you're spending your time.
And one very silly question, which maybe Laura has an opinion on. You mentioned that writing was slow because you have to do write checks.
Oh, yeah, that's just a standard disk.
Why do write checks?
That's in the hardware.
Okay. So we can't turn it off.
We're using commodity disks, which are assume that people want to save their Facebook pictures.
I think one of the major modifications which you addressed is forfeit. How long would that take?
The sort of modifications that I've mentioned have happened in the past. I mean, originally the SX correlation was, pitiful bandwidth by our standards, and the exercise each time to go in and boost the numbers so that it doesn't explode has been, a few days' work actually, but it takes somebody who knows what they're doing. Changing from the FFT to the DFT is also probably not hard. I mean, I think the bigger, mechanically, it's probably not hard. The challenge actually is that it's a program that has been vetted over at least a decade, maybe two, of use, and there are all these edge cases where you want to be careful that your changes for the EHT haven't broken something else for the routine mission. Again, I don't think it's very hard. I think it's just something that somebody who knows what they're doing has to have the time to dive in and actually do. It's not really a roadblock.
Well, I know for tradition that you go for the forfeit approach, but in principle, of course, you could also think in terms of a fringe fitter which works directly on the diffx output, which is an original FITS output, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, diffx to FITS, or even there's been talk of migrating this stuff into the ALMA world and using some lean, mean version of CASA to do this stuff. I mean, there's lots of possibilities for the future. The reality is that, most of the resources to date have been focused on just gathering the data and making it happen. And, fooling with forfeit is stuff that we do in our spare time because it's, you don't have to travel to do that.
Any other questions? I have one question.
Yeah.
On the very last bullet of your slide. So question, I think the EHT correlators will be in Haystack and Max Planck in Bonn. So question is, how deep you are making the compatibility of those two correlators?
The compatibility between the two correlators?
Yeah.
They both have access to the same DiffX software. So at that point, there's actually an ongoing trunk version, which is basically what the raw developers work with from time to time. Versions get tagged, so at the moment, I think last week they tagged 2.4. So an agreement that we're all using 2.4, it's a computer now, and so we are going to get exactly the same product. That sort of test has been done in the past many times for geodesy.
Okay, good. Any other question? Okay, if not, let's thank you again.